first time Alex Berenson visited the show was to talk about The Faithful Spy, which won the 2007 Edgar Award for Best First Novel. He's followed that with four other best-selling suspense thrillers featuring super spy John Wells. And when he was on our show in February, we discussed the latest in the series called The Midnight House. Mr. Berenson has written all of his novels while working at his day job as a reporter at The New York Times, and this new one has been hailed as his best yet. One critic called it standing on the top rung of commercial spy fiction. And we thought that we would re-air that interview for you today. I started out by asking Alex Berenson, when you created John Wells, did you envision him as someone who could carry a whole series?
That is a great question, because the answer is actually no.
You just thought it was a one-shot?
The Faithful Spy, originally I wrote it without an epilogue. And obviously for the 99% of your listeners who have not read the book, that won't make sense. But if you have read the book, you can imagine that that basically implied that he had died. And my publisher said to me, look, this is not a good idea. You have a very good character here. If you must kill him off, you can kill him off. It's your book. But we're going to make you write a funeral for him. And I found that I couldn't do it. I could not just leave. I couldn't bury him. And so since then, I've written three more. This is the Midnight House, the fourth in the series. And there are at least two more coming. After that, I might kill him off. But I've said that before.
Well, Elmore Leonard says he just simply changes the name and writes the same character, because he often sells his books to the movies and then they own the name and he doesn't own it anymore. But what does a character need to have to be able to carry a series? At a certain point, you must have realized that you had to give him a certain amount of complexity so that you could follow all sorts of different threads.
Yes. Well, Wells has a couple of things. He is a super spy, but he is not really a Superman. He's not, he feels the tension of what he's doing. He really has PTSD at this point. And the other thing that makes him different is he's Muslim. In The Faithful Spy, he converts to Islam before the book begins. He's undercover overseas in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And when he's sent back to the United States, he has this tension of being a Muslim in the United States, and the CIA doesn't really trust him. And that has carried through all four books, including The Midnight House.
He's the only Westerner to infiltrate al-Qaeda, and we see him becoming progressively more and more a man without a country.
Yes.
And then he doesn't have a normal life as well. Now, how does a character like this come to you? Obviously, this is not autobiographical. On the other hand, you have been all over the world as a reporter.
It's not autobiographical. Wells is a soldier as much as a spy. When I was in Iraq for the Times in 03 and 04, I did a couple of stints over there. I saw, soldiers in action, and obviously, and I wanted to capture some of what I saw. I have traveled a lot in the last few years. I was in Saudi Arabia last month. I was in Egypt last year for the books. And, as an American, as somebody who's Jewish, I do feel a little bit of the tension of being in these countries, although obviously I'm not spying. They can still be somewhat tough places just to travel around. And so I do feel that. And obviously Wells feels that 100 times as much.
Well, he also seems to fear being bored. At the start of the Midnight House, he's just spent 12 months very far removed from not only the CIA but Washington. His fiance has demanded that he quit the agency, and he can't.
Yes, he's restless. There are soldiers like this. There are foreign correspondents like this. People who just can't quit the game.
And I was wondering about that. It's because they thrive on an adrenaline high. It's something that war correspondents often talk about.
Yes.
And you were covering the occupation of Iraq for the New York Times.
And I did.
Embedded for 5 months.
I did feel that when I came home. I felt very much that, I had been in a place where it was the center of the universe. It was exciting. It was dangerous. Anything could happen. And coming back to the United States did not feel as intense. And I think war correspondents have that. And the longer they stay out, the harder it is.
Mm-hmm. Because although then
they get more and more addicted,
unless they're Chris Hedges and write a book about it to rid themselves, I guess.
Yes, and he explicitly talks about this in War is a Force That Makes Us Strong.
Is the Midnight House a place that really exists?
The Midnight House itself does not exist, but we had rendition facilities or interrogation facilities in Poland. We had interrogation facilities in Romania. they were typically actually in cities rather than on military bases, but we did interrogate terrorists there or suspected terrorists.
And so I'm assuming you did a lot of research, the kind of research that a reporter can do.
I did. You know, people, since the books have been out, you know, for a couple of years, since they started coming out, I get contacted by people sometimes, not usually current agency people, but sometimes former people in the CIA or the FBI who want to talk a little bit. I also read everything that's, you know, out there in the public domain. I travel to wherever I can. I am a reporter at heart, and so I like doing all this research.
But what about the harrowing aspect of this? Writing about something day after day that can really upset people. And I know when I speak to biographers and they say, well, I try to choose a subject that I won't hate completely.
You know, there was a time in the middle of last spring when I was in the, you know, sort of towards the end of writing The Midnight House when I actually did start to get pretty depressed. And I was glad to be done with the book. The book, unlike the first three novels, The Midnight House does not really have a happy ending. I don't want to give too much away, but it doesn't have a happy ending.
But Wells doesn't die.
Well,
not yet.
Not yet.
Alex Berenson is my guest. His latest novel is The Midnight House, and it is published by Putnam. Torture has become a major source of debate in the past few years. What are your views on its use?
Well, this may not be a popular view among some of your listeners. The question that I
pose... Are you suggesting NPR listeners, public radio listeners, are different from other Americans?
Let's just say I'm going to be on a Fox show later today, and
I'm not sure they'll be drooling over this part.
Here, the question I think people have not properly answered is, what do you do with people who won't talk? And we know there are people who won't talk because there are people in prisons in the United States who have gone there rather than make deals with prosecutors. And, you know, as a country, we tolerate some level of criminality, some level of crimes being unsolved because we say, you know, the Constitution is more important. Are we willing to make the same trades for terrorists, for people who are not U.S. citizens? And that's the question that I think the Obama administration is trying to answer.
Although if you speak to people in intelligence, there are two arguments here. And many say in the FBI and in the CIA that the way to get the best intelligence is to develop a relationship with somebody. A torture only gets you the answers they think you want to hear. And if somebody wants to be a martyr, he is going to tell you something that isn't true because that's part of the martyrdom experience.
There are definitely people you can't break with torture, and you definitely run the risk of getting the answers that, you know, again, that the person you're hurting thinks you want to hear. But I do think the people who say torture never works, the sort of building rapport always works, I just think that is not true.
You've consulted for the Series 24, haven't you?
I have.
But you say you don't want readers to see this novel as being either pro or con the use of torture. Why not take a position one way or another?
Because I think it's a very complicated issue. I think that people who are anti-torture, anti-rendition will read this and they'll say, God, you know, this is terrible. And look at what happens to the people who did this. And people who are pro, you know, I don't want to say pro-torture, but pro-torture will read The Midnight House and they'll say, you know what? These guys got information. They probably saved lives.
You don't use waterboarding in The Midnight House.
Yeah, waterboarding is, you know, grade 8 compared to some of this stuff.
I did read an interview with you where you quoted the FBI interrogator of Abu Zabada as saying in his testimony before Congress that our problem is that we're not willing to do it aggressively enough.
Well, he was not saying that we should torture people. He was saying that one of the problems the United States has if it tries to go this route is we are not willing to go it as harshly as other places. And so that's yet another reason why we shouldn't do it. He's anti-coercive interrogation.
Going back to Iraq, yesterday I spoke to Thomas Ricks, and I asked him about coverage of the situation in Iraq, which remains an important part of our national concerns. He said that there's only, I think NPR is the only full-time broadcast employee there, or the Times, the Post, and a few other newspapers, McClatchy, I think, have the only full-time reporters there. We've just kind of written it off, haven't we?
We've forgotten about it. And that's another issue in the book that I tried to bring up, that, you know, these wars are still going on. There's hundreds of thousands of Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan, and yet 99% of the country it's as if the war ended 3 years ago. And I think that's a terrible burden to put on the people who are fighting the war.
Were there certain things that you felt as a reporter you couldn't say, and which might have led you to writing fiction?
There were moods I felt I couldn't capture. I don't ever feel that, you know, as a Times reporter, I was asked to, you know, slant things one way or the other. But I felt that by writing a novel, I could capture moods and I could get inside people's heads in a way that as a journalist you can't.
Hmm. You have left the Times.
I last Friday was my last day, but I'm suffering withdrawal.
The action in this novel goes from California to Cairo and then to Poland to Pakistan. Are these all places you're familiar with?
The only place in the books that I have not visited, Pakistan, or Afghanistan, which is a big disappointment to me. It's something I'm going to do. But basically, I think every other location that I've written about in these books, I've visited.
In the case of Pakistan, there have been problems over the years because the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI, seems to be speaking at both sides of its mouth.
Yes, that's absolutely true. That's something I get into in the novel. And frankly, in my next book, which is centered around Saudi Arabia, we have this problem even more. We deal with the regime that speaks out of both sides of its mouth.
And this book, there's quite a gap between the upper management of the intelligence agencies and the people on the front line. I'm assuming that's always been the case.
I think it has. You know, I'm a registered political independent. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. My sympathies are with the guys and the women doing the fighting. And I think there are people who want power for power's sake, and they mostly wind up in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a lot of sympathy for them.
Well, there are the people who are in the offices, and there are the people who are out there on the front line.
Yes.
And the people on the front line, I'm sure, think they know everything. The people in the offices think, well, I'm in this office because I know everything.
Right. And I get, you know, and I'm sitting back here and getting all this information, so I have a broader global view. One thing one point I would like to make is one of the things the Obama administration is struggling with is what to do with the with the people who interrogated Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and interrogated the other terrorists, you know, the leaders of al-Qaeda that we caught in 02, 03, 04, and that we used coercive techniques on. And I think people need to remember, all of us need to remember what it was like in 2002. We were worried that al-Qaeda had a nuclear weapon. We were worried that there were more attacks, many more attacks coming. We didn't realize that in the end, they were not that formidable an adversary. And so people, I think, on both sides of the spectrum asked for intelligence and sort of said, you know, use what techniques you think you must use. And so to go back now and threaten to prosecute these people, I think, is a big mistake. I don't think that's right.
There's a long tradition of spy thrillers, and they range from the semi-fantasy, like Ian Fleming, to what we assume is the real thing, John le Carré. Did you have certain favorites?
I'm a Le Carré man. A couple reviewers have been kind enough to compare this book really, and The Faithful Spy are the two, The Midnight House and The Faithful Spy are the two that have been compared to Le Carré. And I just hope I'm getting better, and I hope that those comparisons continue.
You wrote over 100 front page articles for The Times when you were there. Are any of those stories, do any of them matter more to you than most? You wrote about the flooding of New Orleans. You wrote about the pharmaceutical industry, which we discussed the last time you were here. You wrote about the Bernard Madoff fraud, the restructuring of Wall Street.
The stories that I like the most are the stories that caused trouble for people or for companies that deserve the trouble, as well as Iraq. The stories out of Iraq, if I have one regret in the last few years, it's that the books, the novels, took me away from being on the front lines. I'm a little bit guilty of what I'm accusing some of these bureaucrats of. I've stayed home rather than getting out to the front lines. But I wrote a couple of stories in 2006, late 2006, about a drug called Zyprexa, which is a schizophrenia drug, a very powerful drug with very serious side effects that Eli Lilly essentially tried to cover up the side effects on. Those stories led to eventually to a guilty criminal plea by Eli Lilly and $1 billion-plus fine. When I was writing stories like that, if war correspondents get addicted to a certain kind of action, I like stories that muckrake And
so you're going to miss that now?
I am going to miss it. I actually have one more story coming out in the paper. I could come out as early as tomorrow, which is one of those kind of stories. And I hope that I'll have some affiliation with the Times, which is such a great institution, and get to write some more.
Although you could always write for somebody else. But yes. I'm assuming that just writing fiction will not be enough to satisfy you.
It definitely won't satisfy that side of me. I do love writing fiction, and there's something about these books that has a permanence that even really good newspaper articles doesn't. I still, I get emails today about The Faithful Spy, which came out 4 years ago, and that feels really good. But at the same time, getting to, really put some skin in the game and influence companies and influence behavior is something that the books can't do directly.
The book, The Midnight House, is published by G.P. Putnam Sons, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Mark.